having some trouble. Okay, so I'm going to talk about statistics of the exoplanets, and at least two people have said to me already, how can you do statistics with 100 objects? Okay, well, it used to be much worse, of course, and I found this old I found this old slide that I thought I'd just show again from 2000 when I made this slide of exciting headlines from the previous year. And it's just to make the point that planet finding has really become a whole industry. And I especially like this one, found two planetary systems result astronomers stunned. Okay. But now perhaps we're not so stunned anymore by planetary systems, you know, and there are more and more, of course, being discovered. And so this is just the current plot from exoplanets.org of the distribution. Is there something? Or a laser?
You carry on, wave your hands.
Anyway, okay, it doesn't matter. This is the current mass orbital radius diagram. And I've marked on here lines of velocity amplitude that a given planet would give. So you can see 40 meters per second, 20 meters per second, 10 meters per second, and 3 meters per second. And just to give you the formula, so you see it, so just to remind you of the formula, here it is down here. And if you stare at this diagram, you can imagine all sorts of, you know, wonderful voids and valleys, and I'll talk about this at the end. But the question really is, how much should we trust the statistics of these objects as we get down to low amplitudes? Where exactly is the detection threshold in the Doppler surveys, for example? And that's something I want to talk about today. I want to give you a sense of, show you some of the data, and give you a sense for the Keck survey. I'm going to talk about work I'm doing. Thank you. I'm going to talk about work I'm doing with Jeff Marcy and Butler and Steve Vogt on the Keck survey, and try and give you a sense of what is the current detection threshold for the survey. Now, this follows on from work that we did with the LIC survey about 5 years ago now. And back then, it was much worse. So here we are back in 1999. And this was the diagram at the beginning of 1999, many fewer objects, obviously. And what we wanted to do then was to just take the LIC survey as a complete sample. And where we have all the stars, we know we can assess the various detection thresholds and so on, and just ask what's going on down here at the low end, because in particular the advertised radial velocity uncertainty is about 3 meters per second, or back then in the range from 3 to 10 meters per second, and yet all the announced planets were way up here at 40 meters per second. And so we wanted to understand better what's happening as you go down towards low amplitudes. And so what we did was, in the LIC sample, and I'm just going to show you the results of that, and then show you some of the current work from the Keck project. But so I just want to summarize what we did with LIC. First of all, we just looked in the sample of 670 stars from the LIC survey, and just asked tried to detect periodicities and ask what signals are in there. And out come the six announced planets, which are shown by the circles. I need to be taller. The six circles there show the announced planets from LIC at that time. And there are a whole other host of periodicities that sort of pop out of the data as being statistically significant. But they weren't announced as planets, they're sort of low amplitude candidates that we found. Okay? And so you can see there are several of those extending all the way down to about 5 meters per second amplitudes. Okay. And also, another thing you can do is you can say if a star doesn't have an announced planet, you can ask what's the upper limit on the velocity amplitude. And so this diagram shows you contours of the upper limits as a function of velocity amplitude. So for example, we found that at 40 meters per second, we could eliminate any planet above 40 meters per second from 50 out of the 60 stars. So as you go down to lower and lower masses, you're less able to say anything and eliminate those objects. So what I want to do today is just talk about current work that we're currently doing with the Keck project along similar lines, and also trying to go further. So first of all, I'll just talk about how do we generally try and detect periodicities. And the important point here is that the time series is unevenly sampled. And so that introduces that makes it tricky. I'll talk a bit about the intrinsic stellar jitter. One of the things as you go to lower and lower and lower amplitudes, you have to start worrying about the internal noise of the star itself. The noise shows intrinsic Doppler. The star shows intrinsic Doppler variability, and so people are just beginning to work on trying to understand that better. Now I'll show you some of the current work we're doing with Keck, and I'll end by talking about some of the ideas about the mass period distribution. Okay. Okay, so the basic data that we're dealing with in a Doppler time series is the measured velocity of the star against time. Okay, so the idea is that we're going to be handed the measurement time, the measured velocity, and the error bar on that velocity. And so here's an example for an unnamed star from the survey. And the first thing that you do, you can almost do by eye, but you can do it using a chi-squared test, is that you look at that time series and you ask, is there anything funny going on? You know, is there more variability than you would expect just given the error bars? And you can see here that's the case for this star, that if you just trusted these error bars, then you wouldn't expect to see these so many of these outlying points. And so you can quantify that. But it turns out, in fact, that for this star, you do expect a reasonable amount of internal noise from the star itself. And so you can explain this excess variability actually as being from the star itself. And so I'll get to that later, how you actually quantify that a little bit later. But first, I want to talk about how you look for a periodicity. Okay. So I'll just spend a couple of minutes on this. If you have unevenly sampled data, you can't just take a Fourier transform, do a fast Fourier transform. You have to do something a little bit more sophisticated. Well, actually, it's not very sophisticated. It's just doing chi-squared fitting. So basically, what you do is you take sinusoids and you do a chi-squared fit of a sinusoid to the data, and you scan through in frequency and try and find a good fitting sinusoid. And the question you ask is how much chi-squared actually improves. So you take that time series I showed you before, you calculate the chi-squared, then you put in a periodicity, a sinusoid, you calculate the new chi-squared, and you just ask how much does the chi-squared improve. And if the chi-squared improves a lot, then that tells you that, you know, there's good evidence that there really is a periodicity there. And the question is, how do you quantify that? So you define a statistic, which is something like delta chi-squared, and normalized in some way. In the 80s, Lamas Scargill looked at this problem when you just had basically fitting a sinusoid, a cosine term and a sine term. And what they realized is that if you introduce this phase tau and you can choose that very carefully, you can eliminate cross terms and you can get a nice analytic expression for this delta chi squared. So people like this. A lot of people use this because it's very, very simple to evaluate. You just have this very nice simple expression. Now this might look familiar. It looks a lot like a Fourier transform. You have cosine terms and sine terms. It's very much like a Fourier transform. So actually, what happened historically was that some people were doing chi-squared fitting through the 70s, and then another group of people tried to generalize the Fourier transform. So they took the Fourier transform formula and they just said, let's generalize that for unevenly sampled data, and they just wrote down what you'd guess for generalization. But Lam and Scargill, really, their key role was to show that those two approaches are actually identical. You know, statistically, chi-squared fitting and these kind of ideas of coming up with a Fourier transform, they're statistically identical. Okay. Now, you still see in the literature, it's actually confusing, you still see some debate about should we use so-called periodograms or should we use chi-squared fitting, but really they're just the same. And so, it's sort of an unfortunate debate that still goes on. And of course, an important point is that you have to include some constant term. We don't know the overall Doppler shift of the star, and so you have to include some constant term. So you can't actually use this nice formula. You have to just do the chi-squared fitting. Okay, but it's pretty straightforward. Okay. So what you do then is to just calculate delta chi-squared as a function of period. Okay, and this is an example for the time series I showed you earlier. And so you see a whole load of spikes as a function of period. This is the power equivalent to the power spectrum. And what you'd like to know is this peak here significant? And to do that, you need to know the statistics of the noise. So if I have a time series with just Gaussian noise, you need to know how does the power spectrum respond to that? And how high would you expect the power to be if it was just noise? And what's nice about that, about the Lam-Scargill periodogram, is that it has a very nice distribution, the analytic distribution. It's just exponential. So if you have, so at a given frequency, if I have a power of 10, then I know the probability that I would get that is e to the minus 10, for example. But the problem is that we're looking at many, many frequencies, and so most people are probably familiar with this. As you look at more and more and more frequencies, you're more likely to get a high power just from noise alone, just by chance. And so if you see a high power, how significant it is depends on how many frequencies you look at. And so you have to include that factor. And if it's just this simple analytic formula, then the way you do that is just to multiply the probabilities over all the frequencies you look at. And essentially, you just end up multiplying this probability by the number of independent frequencies that you look at. Okay. Now, in the fast Fourier transform world, that's very straightforward because the frequencies are actually independent. When you have an evenly sampled time series, the sines and cosines are orthogonal basis functions, if you like. But when you go to unevenly sampled time series, that's no longer the case. And so there's no good analytic way of estimating what this number of independent frequencies is. And so you have to, in the end, resort to Monte Carlo simulations, essentially, to get that, to assess these false alarm probabilities. You're saying, can you just guess M more or less?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
Really
yeah. You can make an estimate, which is that you know that the spacing between frequencies is roughly 1 over the duration of the observations. So you can make a guess, which is just the frequency range multiplied by the duration of the observations, and that's a pretty good guess. That's right. To factors of 3 or 4. So and I'll show you it enters logarithmically. Yeah, that's right. But one reason you might do Monte Carlo, for example, is maybe you don't trust the noise to be completely Gaussian and so on. So you might not want to rely on these analytic formulas. Okay. Oh, yeah, and I just wanted to make this point as well. People often talk about aliasing, and I'll show you some results later where you see that aliasing really isn't so much of a problem. One advantage of having unevenly sampled data is that the aliasing problems sort of go away because you get much better phase coverage. If you have sort of randomly, more evenly, unevenly distributed times, you get more good phase coverage, better phase coverage.
Is it true that you're actually better off doing some random sampling than uniform if you only have so many nights you can observe?
Well, it really depends what you're trying to do. So if you, so people start looking at this, but I mean, it depends. Are you trying to? Do you have some idea of what's there already, and you're trying to get a better measurement, for example?
Blind search.
If you're just doing blind searching,
you only get 20 times to look. Do you want to do it periodic or do you want to do it random?
You want to get the best phase coverage. Right? So, I think random does better. Yeah. Okay. Although I wouldn't say that random's the best.
So if you integrate over a large range of frequencies, then you often find that even though choosing periodic gives you a major decrease in sensitivity right through that period, you get a slight increase over a larger dose. So it really doesn't matter. You can be really stupid, essentially.
If you have many observations.
Right, assuming that you're interested in a broad range of periods.
Yeah.
And that the aliasing is only a narrow window within.
Yeah, no, that's right. Now, actually, I want to get on to this point, which is that often you don't have many observations, and so that's right. we want to find these planets. We want to go and start observing stars, and so we start taking velocity measurements. And the question is, how many do we have to take before we detect something? And maybe in a year you might only have, 3 or 4 observations on a particular star, and so you want to do small number statistics. So I'm in a plot here, which I think is useful. I give you, there's a nice analytic formula here, which I'll mention in a minute. So I'm showing here is the signal to noise that you could detect given the number of observations that you make. Okay. And this curve, the solid curve, which is labeled chi-squared test, that's just doing what I said in the beginning. It's just asking, is the scatter around the, if you fit a constant to the data, is the scatter significant or not? And if it is, then if the signal to noise is larger than this above this line, then that would show up as significant. And you can see that if you just do that, you can detect quite low signal to noise levels. Right? But if you want to actually ask, is there a periodicity there? Is there an orbit there? Then things are much worse. You actually need many more points. So this is just taking the periodogram and asking how large will the signal to noise be before the periodogram power turns up to be significant most of the time, so 90% or 50% of the time. And there's a nice formula you can derive for that. This is the one to look at. This is actually in the large n limit. So in the large n limit, the signal to noise you can detect goes like a logarithmic factor divided by square root of n, basically. So the signal to noise goes down like 1 over square root of n in the large n limit, as you might expect. But coming into this logarithmic factor are the number of independent frequencies you look at and the false alarm probability you demand as your detection threshold. Okay. And like all logarithmic factors, it typically turns out to be about 5. Okay, so that's sort of a handy formula to remember. But you actually deviate quite a lot from the 1 over square root n behavior as you go to a small n. And in particular, if you have, say, 10 observations, it's very hard to actually pick out these orbits. You have to remind. Sorry.
So there's one rate at which you miss things that are there.
Yeah.
Which, the 99.50% you showed in the periodogram.
Right.
And then presumably giving the rate at which you detect things that aren't there the same as you. So what is the rate of false positives that you're looking at?
I think it's probably 99% for the solid line.
For missing.
The other way around.
That 50 or 99?
Yeah, I don't remember. I made this a while ago, yeah.
And is this including eccentric? Or is it all circular?
No, this is circular. Yeah, I can talk about that too. Okay, so let me just show you a little bit some of the things we've been doing with the Keck survey and how that ties in with what we've just seen. So the Keck survey has been running now for about 8 years. And so I just summarized some of the properties of the data in these histograms. So how many observations are there for a given star? What's the duration of those observations? How many observations per year? And then what's the typical Doppler error? What's the error bar on the Doppler on the velocity measurement? So you see the error bars really are around 3 meters per second for a lot of stars. And again, you have a few observations per year typically. And you can see how stars have been added as the survey progressed forwards in time. Stars have been sort of added as the years have gone by. Which I'll come back to. The survey is sort of evolving with time.
How did they get 2 meters per second air bar? There's a section in there.
Yeah, actually, sorry. Yeah, so this is 5, 4, 3, and there is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So actually, there is one star with a 2 meters per second air bar. It's probably. It's an average, yeah. Yeah, it's some kind of average. I think this is actually an inverse, some kind of inverse average, this sort of summing over 1/σ². Okay. So what I want to show you is some results if you just follow this simple recipe. And the idea is to give you a sense of what are they actually detecting? What kind of signal to noises are they detecting? So for each star, just use the periodogram first of all, and that's just fitting circular orbits. And that gives me the best guess at the period and amplitude. And then I take that period and amplitude and then just fit a Keplerian and use that as a Keplerian fit. Ideally, you'd like to actually run a periodogram fitting Keplerians the whole time. But just for, just to make things fast, so I could do it over the last week, I do it this way. Then I calculate this F statistic, the delta chi squared, and ask, is this significant or not, using Monte Carlo? Okay, I'm going to show you what those results give you. Okay, so this is a summary of what you find if you do that. So it's a function of period and velocity amplitude. So I'm sort of switching into the observer's units, if you like, quantities. The green symbols are the announced planets that you pick up when you do this process. You pick up the announced planets. But you also find there are these candidate periodicities. So these are periodicities which are statistically significant, but haven't been announced as planets. Okay, but they're significant at the 1 in 1,000 level. Now, the first thing to notice is that most of the red points actually lie outside the region of the green points, right? Except for this one. So this is an interesting object. It turns out that this one was only added to the survey about 3 years ago, and so. This is the point about the survey evolving. This star, they're just beginning to get enough data now that they can actually, so they're about to basically announce this one. I'm not allowed to say any names. I'd have to kill you if you found out the names. They have to kill me. It's a dangerous business. Okay. But you also see a group of long period objects. Okay, so obviously, if you don't have a whole period, then you're not going to announce them necessarily. I mean, at least two of these actually look very, very good. But if you don't have a whole period, it's very difficult to say, for example, what the mass is. If you allow for a finite eccentricity, you can't actually say what the mass is, because there's some degeneracy there. And then there are all these low amplitude companions. Okay. Oh, this one here? It's because you're fitting a Keplerian. So there's some degeneracy. So the fit sort of locks onto some eccentricity. But you can imagine if for some eccentricities you can have an orbit which is rising very steadily. Right?
So is that actually found in the periodogram or only by
So the periodogram gives you a guess, and that guess would...
That's fine to win.
So what happened is that the periodogram found it here, I think. And then the Keplerian pushed it out. Yeah, that's what happened, yeah. Now, this is sort of illustrative in a way. I mean, this is preliminary. We need to go back and do it more carefully. So, for example, not using the periodogram, not assuming circular orbits in the beginning would help, I think. We're sort of missing. And also, I'm drawing a pretty strict detection criteria, 1 in 1,000 as well. But it's just to give you a sense of how complete the survey is at some level. And to give you a sense of where do you draw this line? Where are they actually detecting things to?
How many stories in the survey?
Oh, I didn't say, yeah. No, there are about 700 included here. It's what?
You don't want to go much lower than 1,000.
No, you don't. You don't. But again, it's this type 1, type 2 issue, right? Yeah. So, just to give you a sense of what's separating here, you can see that in terms of velocity amplitude, it's actually, it's not obvious why is this one announced and this one isn't. But if you look at the signal-to-noise level, you get a sort of a clearer picture. So what I'm defining noise to be here is just the residuals. So I fit the Keplerian, I subtract it, I'm just looking at the residuals, and that's the noise level. So in a sense, if you looked at the light curve by eye, the signal to noise, how clean does it look by eye almost? That's sort of what it's telling you. And you can see there's sort of a cleaner cut here at about 3, something like signal to noise ratio of about 2 or 3.
Wait, you mean by signal to noise here like K over the square root of 2 divided by the RMS?
Where are they?
I don't understand how you can have...
So signal to noise is K over root 2 times the RMS after of the residuals to the Keplerian.
So it's sort of like the single measurement signal to noise.
Well,
in other words, it's not really the signal to noise
that
detection, because otherwise
you
wouldn't have the
one.
Right, that's right, yeah.
The whole signal to noise that you need for detection doesn't go below 1 until you have a large number of measurements. And so it really is the signal noise for both detection and single observation.
I don't buy that.
Like, well, if you guys want to know earlier plots, you should need something like 8 observations before you
keep buying. Let me show you another plot that might help.
Actually, there's a question. What about that one right up there?
Yeah, there's this one. what's happening with this one is that it looks like a very large amplitude fit, but there are only about 9 data points. So I'll show you on the next plot. Okay. That's right. No, that's true. That's true. Yeah. So I don't know what's going on there. So here I'm putting onto this plot now as a function of number of observations, and these curves are the curves I showed you before. Okay. So now you can get a better sense. So for example, the one you just pointed to is this one, I think. So eventually it's going to migrate over and then turn green, I guess. But you can see that there is still some red. There are some red ones out here that you might think, you could go for. And so there's still a sense of looking at the light curve, and seeing, just by eye, seeing that the signal to noise is, bigger than 1, 2, or 3. There's still a sense of that there. And part of the issue,
If you take some of the red squares, just randomly remove, say 50% of the error, of the data. And then how where would they end up? Would they end up? You can make a projection. For the green ones, there's a lack of data. But for the red one, you have too much data.
For some of these red ones.
Yeah.
I mean, for the ones close to the line, it's clearly not true. You'd lose them. Right. But I haven't done that. That's a good. Yeah. See if the periodicity persists in segments of the data. Yeah. Right. That's right. That's right. And that's something that they do. For example, there's a very low amplitude 5 meter per second star with a 5 meter per second signal that's been looked at for years and years and years, has hundreds of observations. But that 5 meter per second, that signal, the periodicity sort of comes and goes as you do what you say. So yeah, that's something that is done. I mean, I didn't do it here just because I wanted to do the simple exercise.
So, Andrew, the difference between this plot and the previous plot is basically Jeff Marcy only announces things that it looks like by eye, that there's a big signal and a small error bar for a given. Is that right? Is that the way to understand what's going on here? Because otherwise, he's not relying on statistics.
They are relying on statistics in the sense that, they carry out this exercise and they have a number. They have a number that's a false alarm probability. There's a combination of factors. It's going down, right? It's going down with time. And eventually, they'll feel confident enough to announce it. Now, what this tells me, though, is that you know, the red, some of the red points are above the curve, and so there's sort of a higher threshold than you guess from the pure statistics. Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of the red points are above the curve.
Yeah, that's right. So there is an extra, but let me talk a little bit about why that is. Okay, so the reason that is because of the intrinsic stellar noise, and so that's what I want to talk about now for a few minutes. That there is intrinsic stellar jitter, and that, oh, they call it jitter, by the way, so I'll keep talking about jitter, and that's what, it's the intrinsic noise of the velocity noise of the star, and that will be periodic. It could be periodic on the rotation time scale, or some convex, you know, the time scale for spots to come and go, or migrate, or, you know, who knows what time scales. So that's really an issue, you know, that we don't really understand that very well, and so that, you know, that's an issue here in actually, do you just trust these statistics or not? Right. So let me just talk about jitter, okay, for a little bit. The person who's done the most work on this is Steve Saar in terms of understanding what causes this intrinsic variability, and there are two main things. There are two main things that are thought to cause the observed variability. One is convective inhomogeneities, and the other is rotational modulation. So the idea is that, for example, rotational modulation, imagine you have a spot on the star that's dark, and imagine that you have a completely black spot that covers a particular fraction of the area. Or in other words, you have a, you know, not completely black spot, but you pretend it's a completely black spot, and that gives you this fraction. So if you just black out part of the star, then you'll black out, say the side that's coming towards you, and then you have the other sides going away from you, you'll end up with a net velocity shift. And that can change with time as these spots evolve. And the same thing with convection. For example, in the sun, we know that in magnetic regions with stronger magnetic fields, the convective velocities are suppressed. And so again, if you sum over all those regions, then you can end up with a net radial velocity when you integrate over the whole star. And it doesn't have to be much area, because the V sine I might be 5 kilometers per second. So you just, you know, you block off a thousandth of that, and you've got 5 meters per second, and that's comparable to the velocity precision. So what people try and do is they try and empirically calibrate that out. So again, so this is some work by Steve Saar with the lick data. What do I want to point to here, really? Let's look at the bottom plot here with the rotation period. So what he did here was look for some quiet stars that don't have a companion, for example, and subtract out the intrinsic noise, the Doppler measurement noise, and just see what's left over, and plot that as a function of rotation period of the star. And what you find is that stars with shorter rotation periods, stars with shorter rotation periods rotating faster show more intrinsic variability, like consistent with being more magnetically active and so on. And roughly, you find that this sigma goes like 1 over the rotation period. You know, so it's telling you it's going like V sine I, for example, which you expect if it's just something like a spot covering part of a star. So recently, people have tried to do better. So Jason Wright with Jeff Marcy, a student at Berkeley, has been looking at the Keck sample. And here's an updated plot from him of rotation period and predicted jitter. Okay, now, the details of this, you know, there are points up here and points down here. Those are occurring, for example, some of these are giant stars in the sample. There just happen to be a few giant stars in the sample. These are K stars. K stars are funny. So what's happening here is that he's calibrating, instead of just rotation period, he's also calibrating, well, he's calibrating against the observable. So he's calibrating against B minus V, MV, and then a measure of the calcium H and K emission. It turns out that that's not necessarily, the measure of the calcium H and K emission isn't necessarily good across all the range of spectral types that are in the survey. So it's been calibrated well for G stars, but for K stars, it doesn't do so well. And so so it's actually quite difficult to pin down what the K stars are doing. And so they're sort of actively working on this right now. This is sort of the current picture of what they have.
Yeah. Just like some of these jitter contaminates planet detections, you might have undetected planets.
If the planets have a physical effect on the star.
It goes both ways. And
you get similar qualitative trends.
Yeah, the only thing is there enough time to spin the star up to these very rapid periods? So that would, I mean, I guess that would make the star have more magnetic regions, you know, so the jitter might go up.
Well, yeah. There's always a bias in the star as they take a sample as well, which is a bias.
That's right.
Against finding this sort of.
That's true. But I think a star that can actually affect the rotation period of a planet that can affect the rotation period of the star is in so close that its velocity amplitude is way above these kind of levels. Right? It's say 100 meters per second, whereas you might induce a 5 or 10. So I don't think it's stopping you from finding them.
No, right? And there's some stars that don't even look at them because they're rapidly rotating. They might be rapidly rotating.
Oh, because they have a planet, right? Sure. Yeah. No, that's right. Yeah.
Well,
that's
right.
Well, they're saying that it would spin up the star. That you spin, yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. Determined. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Sorry. I went through this too fast. Fred took me out for sushi last night, so I'm still recovering from that. Not the sushi, but the drinks. Anyway.
Is that why you're being Poznanski?
Okay. Oh yeah. Sorry. The rotation periods. Yeah. So actually, what they do is they use a calibration from the H and K. So what you actually measure is the calcium H and K emission, and there's a calibration for G and F stars from the Noether-Dahl calculation. So you actually Noether-Dahl calibration. So you, from the H and K, then there's a formula which tells you the spin period. So these rotation periods aren't measured at all. This is really if you wanted to plot the observed quantities, H and K here, H and K emission here. And so what goes wrong with K stars, for example, and M stars, is that calibration just doesn't extend down there. And in fact, it looks like, in fact, I can show you this plot. Yeah.
Before you move on, there's a very clear upper boundary.
Yeah. So I've been trying to understand what's going on here. So. Yeah. So what Jason did here was to divide this plot actually. So let me show you the next plot. He divides the stars into 9 groups and then basically does some kind of SVD fitting, to find some best fitting polynomial or something to try and predict the jitter. And so I think what you're seeing here in these different loci are effects of a third parameter, which would be the if this is H and K, then it would be the mass of the star. So the mass of the star is coming in and giving you different loci. I think that's what's going on, but I haven't understood it. I'm emailing with him trying to understand what's going on. I mean, this is very much in progress, this whole analysis, trying to understand. And it'd be nice to try and put some physics in there, to try and get a better, it's all empirical right now. There are some stars that are measured, but I guess, What's the difficulty you said? Okay. No, that's true as well. Of course, yeah. Right. There's what? Yeah, other people have, right? Yeah. So there is one well-studied sample of I don't know how many stars actually. Yeah, and they looked for photometric and did the calcium H and K and the radial velocity.
Half the G stars observed, and they actually observed spots in all of them.
For as many as half, you think? I don't know.
Of the G stars, I think.
Okay. Oh, of the G. Okay.
That's in their survey. I don't know if it's actually. measured, because some of them don't show it up regularly, finding a few things on the ears.
So just if I just show you this, H and K against B minus V. So the plot I had a coffee yesterday. For G stars and sort of early, and F star, late F stars here, then you see this nice behavior where the older ones have spun down and have less H and K emission, and then you go up to the younger ones. Right? Yeah. I finally figured out which way is red as well, but I had to write a reminder to myself. Yeah. I shouldn't show it. Not in my, but I made this plot, so. Red to the right, okay, that's good, I remember that. Yeah. Okay. But then once you go into the K stars, it's sort of interesting, you sort of fix to a small range in H and K, so you sort of lose this behavior, and the H and K emission almost becomes independent of the color. It's just, you don't see this anymore. And what might be happening here is that the this calibration is... Yeah, and then there's this rapid fall off. But he was saying a saturation of the magnetic activity. Yeah. So you never get to go below here, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just...
Yeah, okay. Is that right? Because I thought also there was an issue with H and K, whether or not it really represents... whether it's really the right thing to look at anymore as you go to... That's the other thing that I've seen as well.
But you're just getting closer to heat, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's understood, really, the change in magnetic behavior there.
So it's also that they're pulling you back to magnetic. The suggestion is you need this rigidly rotating core to get a nice, shearly increased magnetic field.
But as I understood it, you don't see a change at that mass. You see a change later. Right? I think it's at lower masses where you see this change. Right? So it's not a back boundary. So I think this is really a mystery. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, so let me just, I don't know how much time.
Minus 15 minutes.
Okay, that's good. Minus 15, okay. I'll have to go really fast. Okay, so what do I want to do now? Okay, so then also you can calculate upper limits again. So here are upper limits, and just to give you a sense, typically you can rule out 10 meters per second for many stars, or certainly 20 meters per second for most of the stars. And the reason that's important is that it lets us think about the mass period diagram. What can we say about the mass period distribution? Okay, now the hope is to do a better job at this, but this is just the sort of the first thing that you would do. So you can see we can rule out 50% for 50% of stars. We can rule out things above that line, and then there's a 90% line. Okay, so that's at about 13 meters per second. And that's about almost 30 meters per second. So if you want to ask questions about what's going on here, then you can say, you have some power, but it's not obvious. It's not obvious, what the answer is. You have to do a more careful job if you want to ask questions about the distribution in this region, for example.
Question?
Yeah.
I'm surprised that there aren't more candidates over there at the long period with low k's, 3 meters per second, because by this time, we have 5 years now.
Yeah.
Accuracy, the Jupiter should be showing up.
Well, some of this, yeah, I wouldn't take this too seriously. This is all preliminary, so I really wouldn't, this is really done in the last 2 weeks. I think last time I did this, I just had an update of the data, so I redid this, but in the early calculation of the wormhole long periods. And so I had the same thought, and I just want to go back and check at the long periods what's going on. Because in the last time I did this 6 months ago, it was actually, there were more candidates there. So...
Well, what might change if you're finding the periodogram loses sensitivity very rapidly beyond the duration of your observation. And so even if you may see a quadratic or something in the data, the periodogram won't notice that. Okay. So to search for the
So this excludes those hints that you might...
Sometimes it will find them.
But still, if you're talking about 12 years, it's comparable to the... I don't think that's a huge effect for 12 years.
This is not enough. No. Just looking for... When calling candidates, things that just show a drift.
No, so what I'm doing here, Okay, so for very long periods, what I'm doing here is I'm subtracting out any linear trends. Okay. So anything with a very, but that has to be very significant. So anything with a very significant slope, so you know, you're changing by 100 meters per second over the duration of the observations linearly, that gets subtracted out. Right now. So I'm not treating the, sorry? But no, what? No, it's just because for this, when I did this, you know, here I just want to concentrate on the shorter periods, and so I really haven't done the analysis probably for long periods. Yeah. No, I don't think that's true because Jupiter would only be a variation of 12 meters per second over 12 years. Or if you see the linear part, it's going to be, you know, over 8 years, it could be small. It'll be smaller than 12 meters per second, and so that wouldn't get subtracted out. Yeah. I would think it would show up as a red dot, yeah. But I'd like to do the long periods better because there's also a nice paper by Sri Kulkarni has a nice paper where he just points out that when you're doing chi-square fitting, you normally just throw away the phase information. Like in a fast photon, you throw away the phase information. But at long periods, the phase information can actually make a big difference because if you're in a flat part of the light curve or in a sloping part of the light curve for a very long period, if you just have noise, you'll tend to fit the flat part and not the sloping part. And so the phase is no longer randomly distributed, and so you can use that information to help you find these long period guys.
It
and so,
be interesting to know how many candidates.
Yeah, that's right.
Are in the whole cohort of 1,000 stars.
Yeah.
How many of those are showing drifts, which could indicate people?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So that's something that's in the works. Yeah, I don't really have a sense for that right now. Yeah. So I've really treated the long periods badly, and but that's because I'd like to go back and do a much better job. Yeah. You're right, that's the question. I mean, that's how many Jupiters, like I was on. Yeah. Okay, so let me skip through the Bayesian stuff. Okay, and let me just, in the last remaining negative minutes, just point out, you know, people have still, well, do I really have 2 more minutes, or should I stop?
No, carry on.
Okay. I thought this was going to be 20 minutes long. I guess not. So, you know, this hasn't stopped people staring at this diagram and trying to, you know, say, well, you know, what are we learning from this diagram? And actually here, this looks a bit funny at the hot Jupiters, is because my orbital radius is actually quantized here because of the limited precision. Okay, I just grabbed it from the internet and plotted it, but, you know, so this is actually quantized here. But what we've known for a long time is that the hot Jupiters pile up. Okay, that's fairly secure. And also that there's a lack of very massive things. It's very easy to detect something at 10 Jupiter masses at 3 days. We'll see those. Okay, the things in red are more speculative. And there's been some suggestion recently, for example, that... And actually, in our original Lick paper in 1999, we also noted that there's sort of a relative deficit of objects in this region from, say, 10 to 100 days. In other words, you see the hot Jupiters, and then you see a much bigger population out here, and it's almost like this population is tailing off, and then you're bringing in another population close. Recently, the European group do some simple statistical analysis of their data, and they suggest that actually this cutoff here in mass is actually real, that the mass function at large orbital radii is actually dropping off as you go below, say, 3/4 of Jupiter mass. And they put forward a physical reason for that, which is that they talk about this rapid, I guess, type 3 migration. I don't really understand it. Where as you're building up in mass here, eventually you can get to a mass where you switch on the type 3 migration, so you very rapidly cross the diagram and migrate in. So that's the explanation they come up with. And there's also an interesting paper by Ida and Lin just in the last month or so where they also point out you would get some kind of gap here because of the alternative reason that if you have core accretion, you build up a 10 Earth mass core down here, and then you start accreting gas very rapidly, and you shoot across this region. So you might expect to see a deficit of planets here. But as I showed you before, this deficit is sort of coming in at the 10 or 20 meters per second region, and so you know this really needs to be done very carefully. And the statistics done so far, you know, really are. They don't take into account the various upper limits and so on. So I think this is very, very tentative. Yeah, I mean, that certainly from the lines I showed you before, it's very difficult to say something here. And what the Europeans did is they assumed that you could detect everything above 10 meters per second, or everything above 15, I think. So you know, that's clearly not true in our sample, right? So I think, yeah, so I'm very dubious about this. This is more concrete, I think. Then the last thing is what's happening here in the mass function of the hot Jupiters. And so I just wanted to mention one idea that we're thinking about right now. So Doug has suggested that perhaps as the hot Jupiters migrate in, they could capture a rocky core ahead of them in a, say, 2-to-1 resonance and push it in as they migrate in. So there might be a 10 Earth mass core sitting in a 2-to-1 resonance with a 3-day hot Jupiter. And so you see that as a 1.5-day periodicity.
A little less, yeah.
Which, right. And the amplitude for 3 meters per second, if you can get down to 3 meters per second, you can detect something at 10 Earth masses. So it might be an interesting way of actually going after the question, are there rocky cores in these extrasolar systems? And actually, that's an important point, because you might say 1.5 days could just mimic the eccentricity, but if it's slightly out of resonance, then that would help you there. Yeah. Okay. So I'll just stop there.
Is the period valley? I mean, can you quantify that period valley a little bit more? I mean, is there?
I can show you what's being done. This is a paper by Jones et al. And what they did was to look at various cuts. So what they did is to make a mass cut. You might want to make a velocity cut again, but they make a mass cut at 0.6 Jupiter masses. So that's not bad. I mean, that's basically at long periods you don't see anything below about 0.75 anyway. So that's actually, so it's just it's taking everything above 0.75 and then plotting the period distribution and trying different samples. And so they find that no matter what they do in different surveys, for example, you always seem to see some deficit in this region. So in the AAT survey or the LIC survey, Keck survey, independently, you seem to see this. If you make a pretty conservative cut, you know, then you seem to see it. So I think this is, you know, this is reasonably secure. No, yeah, I guess I don't have that. Yeah, but it's because you want to have this title. Is that what I said? Is that what I promised? I'll show you. So I have them in the K. Here they are. It's these two. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, so if... it's the two on the left, that's right. But I would say that one of these... one of these is probably more secure than the other one. I mean, they're significant detections, but one of them, for example, has the periodogram looks very, there's some structure in the periodogram. So when you plot the power spectrum, sort of, you can see structure in the power spectrum. And that's usually indicating that there is some level of aliasing or something like that. So, you know, that it doesn't look as good somehow. I mean, here I am, again, defying my own statistics, but somehow it doesn't look... There's something suspicious. Something smells suspicious about it. But I say what, the one with 9 observations looks like actually pretty good. Now the question is, I don't know where it lies in terms of the tidal radius line. Yeah, I don't know. So I'll check it. Yeah. I mean, this is what I should have been doing instead of sushi. Oh well. Sorry, Fred.